I've been asked to talk really about the public debate, and I want to focus mainly on two issues that have been very much in the media or that will be. And the first one is the Liverpool care pathway controversy. I'm not going to say a huge amount about how the whole protocol came to be and how it works and everything, but I want to look much more about how it's been portrayed in the media and the responses to that and where we're at now with it. And then I want to, in the second half, I'm going to touch very briefly on the Francis inquiry, and then in the second half, move on much more to the pressure for change of the law at the end of life to allow assisted suicide and euthanasia, and just let you know where we're at currently with that. So we're going, if you like, from the bedside and the dying patient through John's meditation on the words of Christ, right back to look at the big picture. So this is much more depressing kind of big picture stuff. And then later in the day, we're going to move much more into the practicalities of what we can do through Catherine's, through Cathy's talks. Now, this headline appeared on the Daily Mail front page in the middle of last year. Top doctor's chilling claim: the NHS kills off 130,000 elderly patients every year. Professor says doctors use death pathway. Around 29% of patients that die are on controversial death pathway, and so on. Now, the Liverpool care pathway, which was the subject of this, of course, had been developed in the 90s and noughties, rolled out across the country with NICE's recommendation. And the whole aim of it was to bring the very best of hospice-style palliative medicine to the bedside in general hospitals. So to give guidance to doctors and other staff who are looking after symptoms of pain, anxiety, nausea, loss of spiritual hope as well, and address them according to a framework which enabled them to make individualized decisions for every patient. But this headline came out of a conference that was organized by a group called the Medical Ethics Alliance in conjunction with a group called ALERT at the Royal Society of Medicine. And this quote was actually never made at the conference, and you won't find it in the Daily Mail article, but it ended up in the headline and it set the tone for the whole debate. And it was derived from the fact that they did a calculation on how many deaths there were in the UK and how many people were on the LCP at the end of life, and then came to this conclusion that 130,000 elderly patients were being bumped off every year. And this chap, Professor Pulicino, a Catholic doctor, neurologist, was the origin of this quote, although he certainly denied to me personally ever saying it, but he's never contradicted it publicly. And the Daily Mail, we were in dialogue with, and they've said, oh, well, it doesn't matter what's in the headlines, it's what's actually in the article that counts, and so on. You wouldn't believe this. So why did they get into this whole issue along with the Telegraph? Well, it was because of the response to this article from hundreds of people who wrote in, relatives with bad dying experiences, and then the whole thing got a life of its own. And this patient was one that Pulicino looked after, who he found had been put on the LCP during a weekend when he was on, not on call, came back on a Monday, took them off it, and the person lived for another 14 months. So this cemented his view that this was what was happening. And then, of course, all of the headlines happened as the newspapers began to dig more and more and look for more stories that were feeding this whole meta-narrative, if you like. And they weren't difficult to find. And people will say, well, it's only the Daily Mail. But what we have to recognize is that the Daily Mail has an online readership of 30 million, and it's actually the second most read newspaper in the whole world after the New York Times. So its influence is absolutely phenomenal in terms of shaping public opinion and political opinion. So this was the idea that, sequin payments were being given and they were linked to the number of people put on the pathway, which was true. It was happening in some hospitals, and perhaps we'll come back to that. NHS millions for controversial care pathway. And so the Telegraph and the Mail work pretty much together, and they do. Story that one runs about anything will be on the other within hours if you follow it. And of course, these two newspapers together have great influence. And then there were other stories that came up. 3,000 doctors putting patients on death lists. This was simply that GPs were being asked to identify the 1% or so of their patients who they thought might die in the next next year so that they could provide better care for them at the end of life. But this is how it was interpreted. Half those on Liverpool care pathway never told that they were on it. And then politicians started to get in on the act. Medics should face GMC over Liverpool care pathway. Doctors who put patients on a controversial end-of-life plan without their consent should face being struck off, a leading legal expert has said. What was most striking about all of this was the apparent complete silence from the medical profession while all this was going on, and it took some months before we started to see any response. And then 22 organisations, which included three Royal Colleges and other groups like Macmillan, Help the Hospices, Alzheimer's Society and so on, put together a statement and published it on a website that it had virtually no media coverage at all. And following that, 1,000 doctors then wrote a letter to the Daily Telegraph, which did get a headline, but it was well back in the paper. And by this stage, the whole story was already well established. And so it was really quite inevitable that the government would be forced to step in order to sort out, you know, the whole mess, because there were more and more stories coming into the press. And so at the end of last year, Jeremy Hunt, the health minister, stepped in, delegated this to Norman Lamb, the care minister, Liberal Democrat MP on cabinet, and he opened this pathway inquiry, if you like. And what they planned to do was to take the work of three inquiries that were going on, one run by the Association for Palliative Medicine, one by the National End of Life Strategy, another by a group called Dying Matters, which brought together a whole lot of stakeholders on the issue. And then it was really a consultation into consultations. They would plan to interview patients. And then the government said, OK, well, there's going to be a full inquiry. Everyone can stop worrying about this. We'll sort it out and get to the bottom of that. And I went along to the initial consultation that Norman Lamb organised, and there were about 20 people representing different organisations there, giving their views on it and contributing. And it was very clear that we had, Professor Pulicino was there as one, and there was very much, if you like, a dialogue of the deaf going on. So on the one side, we had people saying, you know, tens of thousands of people are being killed by slow euthanasia through this pathway. And then on the other hand, we had doctors denying that there were any abuses at all. And, you know, there was no sort of meeting of minds. And it wasn't till an MP there gave her own story about her two parents, one who'd been inappropriately sedated that she was very angry about, and the other parent had been very well looked after, that people recognised that, you know, there's a kind of balanced view in the middle somewhere with this whole thing. Our difficulty for it at CMF was that no one in the medical profession was really speaking out or seemed to be able to get on to the airwaves. The incompetence of the medical profession generally, alongside the ability of Pulicino and a few others to work the media, was absolutely astounding. And of course, it's always difficult taking a kind of middle view on these issues. And when we initially discussed this with our own media advisors, they said, well, the way we read it is that the Liverpool care pathway is like a burnt out car on the side of the motorway. It's not going to go anywhere. And what the government have to do in this situation is actually to call a big consultation, publish some conclusions, and then relaunch something similar, but without the words Liverpool or pathway in it, because those two words give all the wrong connotations. Liverpool, well, what's good about, you know, it's like, can anything good come out of Nazareth sort of thing? But, you know, pathway, just the implication is that you're on a one-way track to death, and that that's the end point of it. So now we're in the middle of this. This was our own response to this was to produce 9 points, and I won't go through these in detail, but essentially what we were saying is that this is a very valuable framework if it's used actually in the way it's intended to be used by skilled staff, properly trained and supervised, and that the people put on it are actually people who are imminently dying within hours and days. It helps people with no experience of end-of-life care to be able to provide hospice, palliative care type care in general hospitals in a very competent way, but that the treatment has to match the symptoms. If people aren't in pain, you don't give them pain relief. If they're not anxious, you don't give them sedation. If they want to drink, then you give them fluid. So everything is individualized for the patient. And we let this out just before the end of the year. This is how the Daily Mail treated it. And in fact, this was front page of the Daily Mail on New Year's Day. And it actually wasn't too bad. One of our 9 points was we said that payments to hospitals should not be linked to the number of people placed on the pathway, but should be linked to training of people to use the pathway properly. And that was a message that was really getting home. And they did actually, if you read that article, list virtually all our 9 points, and it was relatively balanced. But the way these things work is that they're always looking for a headline in order to back an agenda and back an editorial stance. And so where we're at the moment with this is that Lady Neuberger, who's a liberal Jewish peer, has been appointed as the chairman of this committee, which is now hearing evidence from patients and relatives in these three groups I mentioned, and they will produce a report. You can make submissions into the inquiry, and sometime in the summer we'll get a report which comes out, and it'll say something pretty much along the lines I've said. I think that, you know, what we need is a new framework, but not, it won't have the words Liverpool and pathway in it. So the problem is that any tool can be inappropriately used by unskilled people. You can use a shovel to build foundations for a house, or you could kill somebody with it if it's used inappropriately. And of course, if you take an elderly person who's not in pain and not anxious and wants to drink, and you put them in a side room and give them pain relief and sedation and so on, and you don't supervise them or hold anybody accountable, then you get problems. And so we will wait for that. You might have seen the Dispatches program on Channel 4 just a week or so ago on this issue, and it highlighted, first of all, some of the stories from people like Pulicino, but then also the results of a survey that the BMJ recently held, in which 9 out of 10 doctors said that if I was in my last hours or days of life, I'd actually want to be managed with this kind of framework. And so we have this continuing dialogue of the deaf to some extent. But I think what the whole drama does, and we can talk about this later in panel discussion, but it highlights, first of all, the anxiety, the fear of death that there is. Secondly, some of the problems when you add protocols into the background of an NHS that's under increasing pressure, run by top-down managerial agendas, with the impetus to save 20 billion of inefficiency savings over 4 years and so on and so forth. And I'm not going to say much about the Francis inquiry. There's been so much ink spilt already, and we all know about what happened at Mid Staffordshire Hospital, and we also know that it's an ongoing problem that needs to be addressed, and it wasn't only Mid Staffs that was affected in the whole thing. And these failures that happened there have been very well highlighted in the media and the press, the medical literature and so on. The culture focused on business, not patients. Standards not focused on the effect of service to patients themselves. Tolerance of poor standards, failure of communication, no one taking responsibility for monitoring, and so on and so forth. So, switching from the LCP onto the whole euthanasia issue. And there are two laws in Britain. Under the Suicide Act, it's not legal to encourage or assist a suicide. You go to prison for up to 14 years. And under the murder law, which is not an act of parliament, but just a statutory law, if you intentionally take the life of another person, even for compassionate reasons, that's murder. And that carries a mandatory life sentence. Now, of course, there's a huge program to try and change that at the moment. There was a consultation back in 1994 in the House of Lords, which came to the conclusion that any change in the law would mean that vulnerable people would feel pressure, whether that was real or imagined pressure, to end their lives so as not to be a burden upon others. And that has been really for the last 20 years the most powerful argument against any change in the law, which seems to have a very broad currency in terms of acceptance by people in the corridors of power. The other thing that the Select Committee came out with was that the need to invest much better in end-of-life care, support for disabled people, and good palliative care. But over the last 6 years or so, we've just seen ongoing pressure to change the law. We've had three bills, two in the House of Lords, one in Scotland, each of which has been defeated by fairly substantial majorities. But the pressure goes on and on and on and on. It's a war of attrition, and it's happening not just in Britain but all around the world, and driven at the end of the day really by a new atheist mindset and secular humanist values. It's a culture war, if you like, a clash of worldview that's driving this whole thing. Now, on each occasion, these were the arguments that convinced Parliament not to change the law. But it's very noticeable that in all the opinion polls, 80 to 90% of the population, depending on what question you ask, seem to support a change in the law because of the way that they've been influenced, particularly by cases in the media. So public safety, if you change the law, you put pressure on vulnerable people. Palliative care, if you look after people properly, they don't want it. And the status quo is okay. It's got, first of all, the penalties the law holds in reserve to deter abuse or exploitation are working, and there's a lot of flexibility both to prosecutors and judges in order to temper justice with mercy in hard cases. So if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And these arguments are the things that have held sway in Parliament, despite the fact that our society's become much, much more secular on other issues like, you know, for example, gay marriage or abortion. These arguments still seem to hold. The Debbie Purdy case, which went all the way up to the House of Lords, what's now known as the Supreme Court, I won't go into the details of this, you've heard a lot about it already, but the result of the Purdy case was that it led this man, the Director of Public Prosecutions, to have to produce guidelines about when he decided to prosecute or not to prosecute in a given case of assisted suicide. And there were draft guidelines, a consultation, definitive guidance came out about 3 years ago, and he applies it. And this is basically what it means. If you're far less likely to be prosecuted if the victim had a settled wish to commit suicide, assistance was of minor nature only, like pushing a wheelchair or something, and the assister cooperated fully with the police. And this was really the key thing. The assister was wholly motivated by compassion. Well, how you work that out is a mystery. And the mystery writer P.D. James said at the time that this was a murderer's charter. It was a kind of tick box approach that would-be abusers and exploiters could show that they'd, you know, followed all the guidelines and that they could therefore escape prosecution. But in actual fact, what's happened, well, there haven't been any prosecutions, but at the same time, we haven't seen any big increase in assisted suicide cases. All that's really happened is that a lot many more cases are going across the DPP's desk. He's having to do a lot more work, but the deterrent effect of the law seems to be there still. And it's largely there because of the fact that the law hasn't changed and the guidance of medical protection societies hasn't changed. The GMC guidance hasn't changed, and doctors know that if they got involved, there could be a real risk of prosecution for them. And for that reason, they're not getting involved. Now, what are we facing at the moment? Well, this year is going to be a huge year in this. There are two court cases, both involving people with locked-in syndrome or a condition close to that. And Tony Nicholson, you will have all seen on your television screens, you'll know he died last year after he lost his case, but his wife has been granted permission to take it on. And the case has been joined with that of another man called Martin. We don't know his real name. And Care Not Killing, of which CMF plays a leading role, intervened in both cases. We had lawyers working with us pro bono on it. And both those applications for, if you like, permission for assisted suicide in the case of Martin or euthanasia in the case of Nicholson were rejected last year. But they're coming back to the Court of Appeal, and on the 13th to 14th of May, we'll see it. It's likely that they'll lose there too. They'll then, if they do, appeal to the Supreme Court. So this will be a slow-running thing over many years that may eventually go to Europe. And without going into all the details of these cases, suffice it to say that if either of them won, it would we'd see a massive sea change in the law, which would really open the floodgates, which is why we're so involved in it. We had Lord Falconer's Commission on Assisted Dying, or some would call it the Con Mission on Assisted Dying, because he set up this private consultation, handpicked people who were already in favour of a change in the law, came out with predictable conclusions, and he's now bringing forward a bill later this year along the lines of the Oregon law, which is to legalise assisted suicide for people who are mentally competent adults but with less than 12 months to live. We haven't seen the final bill yet, but it's going to be published in May. And in fact, there'll be two bills this year, along with Falconer's bill. Margaret MacDonald is bringing back another bill in the Scottish Parliament, which she's got the necessary signatures for. And we don't yet know the process or the timescale, and it's likely that we're not going to see that until the summer of this year. But her consultation document suggested that she wanted assisted suicide on an Oregon-type model for anyone with a terminal illness or a terminal condition. Whatever that is, I suppose that also includes life being a terminal condition. But her last bill was defeated because of the fact that it held within its gambit, if you like, people who were disabled as well as people who were terminally ill. And you will shortly hear, because Claire's been tweeting about it, that the RCGP will be holding a consultation amongst its members about whether the Royal College of GPs should go neutral. It's not yet made public, but the Council of the RCGP has met and made that decision, and it's just a matter of the timing and process that we're waiting to hear. Claire Gerada retires later this year. Of course, there's a lot of celebrity support for change. The high-profile cases that we've seen going all the way through to Dignitas, and at the moment we now have this, if you like, massive culture war going on where a huge number of groups are getting involved. Dignity in Dying is the main one, 1.2 million turnover, 20 staff, a third of their income coming from legacies, and they're driving their agenda very powerfully. They're helped by this new organisation called Health Care Professionals for Assisted Dying. If you're an emeritus professor and not teaching medical ethics from a Judeo-Christian basis like John Wyatt, then there's a good role for you to have a second life on this. Most of them are professors of psychiatry and geriatrics who are involved. And then we have the retired doctors groups, Michael Irwin and Libby Wilson, who lead these two rather interestingly named groups, North and South, respectively, of Hadrian's Wall. And then there's the more radical groups like Philip Nitschke of Exit International, the Antipodean colleague of mine, but I might add from the other side of the Tasman Sea. And what's been interesting over the last few years is to be seen other groups coming into the whole debate. And the last two or three years, the entrance of the National Secular Society and the British Humanist Association pushing for a change in the law, who see this as a prime culture war issue. And in between them, the Secular Medical Forum, which has been deliberately named so it can have the acronym SMF as opposed to CMF. They basically take all our policies and turn 180 degrees, and that's how they formulate their policies. So we've got this range of people who appear moderate at one end and people who are very radical at the other. And the danger of this is that what is actually quite a radical view, which is what DID is pushing for, begins then to look like the safe middle ground. And that's the main challenge that we're facing. Of course, there are a lot of stakeholders against Care Not Killing Alliance, of which CMF plays a leading role. I'm still acting as the campaign director for that on a pro bono basis, and Andrew Ferguson chairs the strategy committee. So he and I are very much involved in doing a lot of the media for that as well. The role of disability rights groups is key. Baroness Jane Campbell is probably the main reason that Falconer's amendment didn't get through in 2009. And they have been very strong advocates with us against any change in the law because they know exactly what's going to happen. They say that they are the canaries in the coal mine because they're the ones to give the warning cry to the rest of society. The medical profession currently largely remains opposed, although every year we're fighting a battle at the British Medical Association to stop it going neutral. And of course, we have the RCGP, as I've already talked about. And at the moment, still in Parliament, we have leaders in the House of Commons generally opposed. Survey last year in September showed that 70% of MPs would not back a change in the law. And in the House of Lords, we have a number of lawyers and doctors who've been against it. But what's happened now in the House of Lords is that with 200 new peers and this coming back and some new very liberal leading lawyers who've come in, it's going to be a completely different fight this year. These arguments remain the ones that have held currency with people of all faiths and none. You change the law, you put pressure on vulnerable people, and these pressures are particularly hard felt at a time of economic recession when many families are struggling. Good palliative care is what we should be pushing, but we have to be arguing that the current law works well in providing both deterrence and also a discretion and mercy to those. It has both a stern face and a kind heart. Very few small numbers going to Switzerland. If we had an Oregon-type law, we'd have 1,200 deaths a year, not 15 to 20. If we had a Dutch law, we'd have 13,000. And we could come back in questions to what's happening later in the day in the Netherlands and Belgium in particular, which is rapidly becoming the euthanasia capital of Europe. But it's very worrying. And I think just the thought I want to leave you with is that with the growing number of elderly people and the change in the structure of Britain's demographics, if there was any change in the law and you were looking at things purely from an economic point of view, given that 70% of elder abuse happens in families, up to half of total lifetime health care expenditures occur in the last 6 months of life, barbiturates are very cheap alongside chemotherapy and palliative care, this is the question: do you want assisted suicide and euthanasia to be a healthcare option? Because when it's made one, as in Oregon, then people like Barbara Wagner, who was suffering from cancer, do get letters from the Oregon Health Authority saying, well, we can't pay for your chemotherapy, but we could pay for assisted suicide if you like to exercise that option. General practice is all about options, isn't it? Putting the options forward. And I'll just leave you with this final thought. Now, we have low fertility rates, an aging population, 3 people in the workforce to every 2 younger than 18 are over 65 now in Europe, but by 2060 it's going to be 1 to 1. Add into that debt, economic difficulty, slashes in budgets, the breakdown of the family so that many people no longer have anyone to look after them, and you've got a very toxic situation indeed. Now, these graphs here are not the UK, they're Japan, and Japan is the most extreme example of the demographic winter that we're seeing in the Western world, but every other Western country is following this pattern. So in 1950 on the left, you've got 35% of people under the age of 15. By 2050, it will be 8%. In 1950, 5% are 65 or over. By 2050, it's going to be 40%. And so when people say that the generation that killed its children, abortion, will be killed by its children, euthanasia, we have to remember this demographic picture. And I'd say that's a chilling prophecy which will, I think, certainly come true unless there is a major change in British society in terms of our attitudes and structure and so on. And that is not going to happen, folks, without, I don't think, you know, something along the lines of the evangelical revival that we saw in the 18th century.